than at any time since Laogan. She felt it emerge through the floorboards and penetrate her body, conjoin with her blood, and pull her back down through the floor into the cellar of the next world. That's what was waiting, what had always been waiting, the next world. Whether it was above or below, white or black, cold or warm, it was not this world, with its comforts and distractions and knowable ills. Maybe it was nothing at all. Maybe it was just absence. Absence of self, absence of sense, absence of soul or memory. She realized now that in Haiti, even before the camp, as far back as Port-au-Prince and the corpses smoldering in the streets and stacked in the parking lot of the hospital, stacked like old cars in junkyards, beginning to swell and balloon in the heat, as far back as then, the truth of their deaths became the truth of her own. We are not special. We are lit from within by a single candle flame, and when that flame is blown out and all light leaves our eyes, it is the same as if we never existed at all. We don't own our life. We rent it. She searched the rest of the apartment, but it was clear they weren't there. Her initial instinct had been right. If they'd been waiting to kill her, they would have done so the moment she came through the door. She returned to the bedroom and packed a backpack with hiking boots, several pairs of warm socks, a heavy wool coat. She took a gym bag with her into the kitchen and added one carving knife, one paring knife, a flashlight and batteries, half a dozen power bars, several bottles of water, and the contents of the fruit bowl on the counter. She left the bag and the backpack by the door and returned to the bedroom. She changed into cargo pants, a thermal long-sleeve t-shirt, a black hoodie. She tied her hair back into a ponytail and covered it with a Newbery Comics ball cap. She opened the floor safe in his closet and removed the cash there and took it and the gun into the bathroom and placed them on the counter and looked into the mirror for a long time, and the woman who stared back at her was exhausted and angry. She was also afraid, but not paralyzed with it. She said to herself, with the compassionate authority of an older sister speaking to a younger, "It is not your fault." What's it? It was Witty and Esther and the ex-nun Veronique and all the dead in Port-au-Prince. It was her mother's toxicity and her father's absence and Jeremy James's abandonment. It was Sebastian's disappointment in just about everything she did. It was the feeling she'd had as long back as she could remember that she was unforgivably inadequate and worth abandoning. And the voice in her head was primarily correct. Most of it was not her fault. Except for Witty. Witty was her insurmountable sin. Witty was 4 years dead, and Rachel, who'd gotten her killed, was 4 years older. She lifted a picture of her and Brian off the dresser, their unofficial wedding photo. She looked in his lying eyes and his lying smile, and she knew she was just as much a liar as he was. From grade school through high school, college, grad school, and out into the working world, she had assembled herself into a character she played every day for most of her life. Once that character failed to connect with the audience any longer, she disassembled it and assembled a new one. And on, until, after Haiti, after Witty, she couldn't reassemble. All that was left of her was the nub of her hollow, manufactured self and the whole of her sin. We are liars, Brian. We. She left the bedroom. In the living room, she realized her laptop wasn't on the bar where she'd left it. She looked around for a few minutes, but surmised pretty quickly that Lars and Ned had taken it with them when they left. Fine. She had a smartphone. What she didn't have was a car. Even if Kessler hadn't frozen her credit cards, she couldn't rent a car or use Zipcar because then she'd be a cinch to find. She looked around the apartment again, as if it could tell her something, looked everywhere except at the corpse at her dining room table. And then she realized that's exactly where she should be looking. The key fob was in the right front pocket of Caleb's jeans. She could see the bulge of it when she came around the table to him. She didn't look at his face. She couldn't. What about Haya? She wondered. What about AB? At the party, just 4 days ago, Caleb had lifted his daughter in front of his face and she'd gripped his upper lip and pulled it toward her like a drawer. He'd let her do it. He'd laughed, even as it was clearly painful, and when Annabelle released his lip, he held her to his chest and pressed his nose to the crown of her head and breathed her in. Caleb had been an actor, just like Brian, just like her, but the acting was just one aspect of the whole. He wasn't acting the father, he wasn't acting his loves, wasn't pretending what his dreams and desires and hopes for the future were. He had been, she realized, her friend. She'd always thought of him as Brian's friend, as Brian's partner, because those roles, there was that word again, had been firmly entrenched when he'd entered into his association with her. But time and attrition had created a familiarity and comfort with each other that one could only call friendship. She reached into his pocket. The denim was stiff, and his body was stiffer. Rigor mortis had set in, and it took her a solid minute to work the key fob up his thigh and out of the pocket. In that time, it occurred to her that if they'd never returned here so she could email her book to herself, he might still be alive. But no. No, 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 that big sister's voice whispered in her ear. He stayed behind to drink. He stayed behind to collect his thoughts before an hour's drive. And if that weren't enough, whatever game he and Brian were playing, they had set it in motion a long time ago. She looked at him now, for a full minute. You're not my fault. The tears fell, and she wiped at them. But I'll miss you, she said, and walked out of the apartment. Chapter 28 Plunging. She gassed up Caleb's Audi and then got breakfast at the Paramount on Charles Street once it occurred to her that she hadn't eaten in about 24 hours. She didn't feel hungry, but she ate like it. She drove back over into Copley Square and parked at a meter on Stewart Street and walked the small side street that ran between the Copley Plaza Hotel and the Hancock Tower. She passed the loading dock and the rear door where she'd seen Brian exit in the rain and climb into the black Suburban. She walked around the building, walked along St. James, and at one point she saw a dozen Rachels reflected and re-reflected in the panes. They formed a disjointed ribbon, like a chain of Rachel dolls cut from construction paper. When she rounded the corner, they all took flight, and she never saw them again. It was almost 9, and the streets were filled with morning commuters. She reached the entrance to the skyscraper and followed the stream heading in through the revolving doors. She found the directory to the right of the security desk. She went through the A's and saw no Alden Minerals. Went through the B's and saw nothing she'd consider germane to her quest. But in the C's, there it was. Cotter McCann, the venture capital firm Glenn O'Donnell had mentioned. It wasn't a guarantee, but it was certainly a fair assumption that Brian had come here that day to meet with representatives of Cotter McCann and sell off a part of his mining interest. She exited the building and walked back a block to the central branch of the Boston Public Library. She passed through the McKim building into the Johnson building, where the computers were, and set to researching Cotter McCann's acquisition of an interest in Alden Minerals. There wasn't anything on it save one tiny item in the Business Digest section of the Globe, which must have been the source of Glenn's information, because it told her nothing new. She clicked off and looked up Baker Lake, worked her way to a satellite map, click, click, clicked the zoom icon until she could discern the only abodes in the area, 8 roofs in the northeast corner of the lake along the Canadian border, 3 more she almost missed, peeking out a bit to the west of the 8. She printed several images of the region, zooming out a little bit more each time, until she was satisfied she had a reasonable representation of the area. She retrieved the pages from the printer tray, quit all applications, cleared her history, and left the library. Just before Haiti, Rachel had done a story for Little Six on the tax breaks the Commonwealth was offering to lure Hollywood film production to Massachusetts. In order to assess the economic effect of the tax breaks on the local economy, she'd interviewed Hollywood studio execs and state house reps on ways and means, as well as local actors, location scouts, and one casting director. Her name was Felicia Ming. She was a jaded gossip, as Rachel recalled. She and Rachel had met for drinks a few times in the months before Rachel left the country for Port-au-Prince. They'd fallen out of touch after that, but Felicia had sent her a few kind emails after the meltdown, and Rachel still had her contact info in her phone. She called her, standing outside the library, and asked her how she'd track down an actor starring in a local production.
"Why are you trying to find him?"
Rachel tried a version not far from the truth. "He got into a drunken tiff with my husband in a bar the other night."
"Oh, do tell."
"I just feel bad. He got the worst of it, and I want to apologize to the guy."
"Was this fight over you, honey?"
Rachel hoped her instinct was right on this one. "It was, I'm afraid, yeah."
"Somebody's making a comeback," Felicia Ming said. "You return to this world with us, honey, and you make them crawl to you."
Rachel forced a chuckle. "That's the plan."
"What company is he working with right now?" Felicia asked.
"The Lyric Stage."
"What's his name?"
"Andrew Gaddis."
"Give me a sec."
While Rachel waited, a homeless guy walked by with his dog. Rachel recalled the night Brian forfeited his coat to a needier soul in the park. She gave the dog a pat and the homeless guy $10, and Felicia came back on the line. "He's at the Demange, its corporate housing in Bay Village." She gave Rachel the address.
"Want to grab a drink soon, now that you've rejoined the living?"
Rachel actually felt bad about lying.
"I'd love to."
20 minutes later, she stood on a sidewalk in Bay Village and rang his doorbell. When his voice came through the intercom, it was groggy.
"Yeah?"
"Mr. Gaddis, it's Rachel Delacroix."
"Who?"
"Brian's wife." The pause that followed was so lengthy, she finally said, "Mr. Gaddis, you there?"
"I'd like you to go away."
"I won't." The calm force in her voice surprised her. "I'll wait down here until you have to come out, and if you slip out the back, I'll come to your performance tonight and cause a scene in the middle of it. So let's..." The door buzzed, and she grabbed the handle and entered the building. It smelled of Lysol and linoleum in the lobby, Indian food as she climbed to the second floor landing. A woman passed her, leading a huffing French bulldog on a leash. The dog reminding Rachel of something you'd get if a pug impregnated a wombat. Gaddis was waiting in the doorway of 24, his stringy gray hair yellowed by nicotine. He tied it back into a bun as he led her into the apartment. It was a simple layout, kitchen and living room to the right, bedroom and bathroom back to the left. The window at the back of the living room opened onto a fire escape.
"Coffee,"
he said. "Sure, thanks." She took a seat at a small round table by the window, and he brought them each a cup of coffee, put a carton of creamer and a bowl of sugar between them. In the morning light, he looked even worse than the drunk she'd met Saturday night. His skin was scaly and pink, and blue veins had erupted along the sides of his nose like electric bolts. His eyes swam.
"I have rehearsal in an hour, and I have to shower, so we're going to have to move this along."
She sipped her coffee. "You and Brian were actors together."
"Caleb, too."
He nodded.
"Brian had more raw talent than I've ever seen before or since. We all knew he'd be a star, as long as he didn't find a way to fuck it up."
"What happened?"
"Couple things, I guess. He had no patience, and maybe, I don't know, he didn't respect it because it came so easy to him. Who knows? He was angry, I remember that. Charming and angry. Cut quite the romantic figure in that regard. Chicks were fucking crazy about him. No offense."
She shrugged and drank her coffee. Say what you would about Andrew Gaddis, he made good coffee. "What was he angry about?"
"Being poor. Brian had to work. I mean, we were dawn to dusk at school. We had acting classes and improvisation classes and improvisational movement classes. We had dance and playwriting and stagecraft and directing classes, voice class, speech class, and something called Alexander Technique, which taught command of the body so you could use it as an instrument, you know? Morphet to your will. All that work was no joke. You'd get to 6 o'clock, your eyes would be shutting and your muscles screaming and your head throbbing. You'd go to bed or you'd go to the bar. Not Brian, though. Brian would go to work until 2 in the morning, and then right back at it at 7. Most of us were in our mid-20s, so, shit, plenty of energy. But even at that age, we wondered how he did it. Then all that work added up to nothing anyway when he got kicked out.
He was kicked out of Trinity? Gaddis nodded and took a long chug of coffee.
I look back now, and I think he was probably popping a lot of speed or doing blow to keep up his pace. Either way, he was getting edgier and edgier during our second year. We had this one professor, real to the manner-born dilettante douchebag named Nigel Rawlins. He was one of those break-you-down-to-build-you-up kind of teachers, but I always suspected he didn't really know about building anyone back up, he just liked to break them down. He was notorious for getting students to drop out. He built his rep on it. One morning, he went after the only student there who was poorer than Brian. This kid had Brian's bare pockets, but not his talent, not a tenth of it. Anyway, Nigel Rawlins, one morning they're rehearsing a scene set in a men's room, right? And this kid's got a monologue about unclogging a toilet, that's all I remember about it to this day. I think it was a student piece. And the kid, he's just not selling the scene. He's fucking gassing it, to be quite honest, which is setting Nigel off. He tore into that kid for being a shit actor and a shit human being, an embarrassment as a son and a brother, a source of shame to anyone unlucky enough to have him as a friend. He'd been on the kid for months, but that morning he was the fucking Terminator, kept coming and coming. The kid pleads for him to stop, but Nigel gets stuck in this rage loop about how the kid is a log of shit covered in hair that's clogging the drain, and it was Nigel's job to plunge him the fuck out of the class before he dragged everyone else into that clogged toilet with him. So Brian, man, I mean, nobody ever even saw him leave the stage, but when he came back, he had an actual plunger in his hand, not the fucking stage prop, and it was dripping with piss. He flipped Nigel on his back, and he fitted that plunger over his mouth and nose, and he just started plunging. Once, Nigel managed to push his head off the floor, grab at Brian's legs, and Brian punched him so hard in the center of his face you could hear it in the back row of the theater. And Brian went back to plunging and plunging and fucking plunging Nigel's face until Nigel passed out.
He sat back and drained his coffee.
They kicked Brian out the next morning. He hung around Providence for a while, delivering pizzas, but I think it grew too embarrassing, you know? Handing over pies and taking sweaty bills from people you used to party with. He lit out one day, and I didn't hear from him again for, I don't know, 9 years?
She sat with that a bit, wishing she hadn't heard it because it actually made her like the lying prick again, if only for a moment. What happened to the other student? The one who was being abused.
You mean Caleb?
She chuckled in sadness and surprise, and Gaddis refilled their coffee cups. She said, "When's the last time you saw Brian before the other night?"
10 years ago, maybe 12.
He looked out the window for a bit.
Can't remember exactly.
Any idea where he'd go if he didn't want to be found?
That cabin he has in Maine.
Baker Lake? He nodded. She showed him one of the satellite photos. He looked at it for a bit and took a Sharpie from a cup on the windowsill. He circled the cluster of 3 rooftops.
Those other 8 cabins over here? They're part of a hunting camp. These 3, though? Brian owns them. We had a Trinity reunion there around 2005. Not too many showed up, but it was fun. Don't ask me where he got the money for them because I didn't ask. Brian preferred the middle cabin. It was painted green when I was there, had a red door.
And that was 2005?
Or 2004.
He nodded at the bathroom door.
I got a shower.
She returned the satellite photo to her bag and thanked him for his time and the coffee.
I don't know if this is worth anything,
he said as she reached the door.
But he looks at you different than I've ever known him to look at anyone.
He shrugged.
Then again, he's a very good actor.
He remained in the bathroom doorway. She held his gaze and saw his eyes change as, she presumed, he watched hers do the same.
"Wait," she said slowly.
Andrew Gaddis waited.
"He paid you to crash our party that night, didn't he? He staged the whole fight, everything."
Andrew Gaddis stroked the jamb of his bathroom door, a jamb that looked to have been painted so many times over the decades she bet the door never latched correctly.
"And if he did?
Why are you helping him?"
His shoulders rose and fell in a half-shrug.
"When we were young, at a crucial time in the development of ourselves, Brian and I were great friends. Now he's where he is, and I'm where I am."
He looked around the room, which suddenly appeared grim and insignificant.
"And I'm not sure who we are anymore. When you spend so much time in the skins of others that you don't even recognize the smell of your own anymore, maybe the only allegiance you owe is to the people who remembered you before the makeup and the stagecraft took over."
"I don't follow," she said.
He gave that another half-shrug.
"You remember how I told you that at Trinity we studied every discipline, no matter what our focus? Dance, acting, writing, what have you?"
He gave her a soft, distant grin.
"Well, Brian was a hell of an actor, like I said. But you know what his real passion was?"
She shook her head.
"Directing."
He disappeared into the bathroom. He closed the door behind him, and she was mildly surprised to hear it latch. Chapter 29. Enough. I-95 took her through Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and what she would have previously described as deep into Maine, up all the way to Waterville. But from there, she had to leave the interstate and hop onto Route 201, after which everything grew first rural, then desolate, then slightly ethereal, the air and sky turning the cast of newspaper, the land eventually disappearing in thickets of trees as tall as skyscrapers. Soon the sky was gone, and all she knew of the world was the brown trunks and the dark treetops and the ashen road feeding into the space between her thrumming wheels. It felt as if she moved under heavy cloud cover. Soon that gave way to the sensation of driving at night, even though it was 3 in the afternoon in late May. She reached a clearing between two forests, miles of green. Farmland, she presumed, though she couldn't see any houses or silos, just swaths of well-tended fields spotted with cows and sheep and the occasional horse. Her phone was propped in the cup holder, and she looked down at it long enough to confirm it no longer received service out here. When she looked up again, the sheep, or goat, she'd never be sure which, stood 6 feet from her bumper. She spun the wheel and swerved off the road, bounced into a small ditch hard enough to bang the top of her head off the roof and the bottom of her chin off the steering wheel. All 4 wheels detached from the earth. She shot back out of the ditch like something strapped to a booster rocket and hit the road on the front quarter of her left bumper. The airbag punched her in the face as it deployed, and she could taste blood after she bit her tongue. The back of the vehicle rose, and the front lifted off the pavement again. It flipped twice to the soundtrack of breaking glass, grinding metal, and her screams. It came to a stop. She was upright. She shook her head several times, and small chunks of glass, dozens of them by the sound of it, flew out. She sat where she was a while longer, chin resting on the airbag like it was a pillow, until she ascertained that she wasn't in any pain, nothing felt broken. She didn't seem to be bleeding anywhere but her tongue. The back of her head throbbed, and her neck felt stiff, and the muscles closest to her spine had turned to rock, but otherwise it seemed possible she was all in one piece. The console compartment and glove compartment had divested themselves of their contents, and they were strewn across the dashboard and passenger seat and footwells. Maps, insurance cards, registration, packets of handkerchiefs, loose change, pens, a key. She unlocked her seatbelt. She bent over the passenger seat. She pushed aside a pair of cracked sunglasses and lifted the key off the mat. It was small and thin and silver. Not a house key, not a car key, a locker key or padlock key or safe deposit box key.
Was this the key? Which would mean Caleb had had it, not Brian, which would mean he'd died rather than give it up. Or it was just a key. She pocketed it and got out of the SUV. It sat dead center in the middle of the road. The sheep or goat was long gone. The black crescents of her skid marks snaked from the center of the road, off the edge, and vanished where she'd left the road. A shower of glass, some clear, some red, marked her return, and littered the road along with pieces of chrome, hard black plastic, and a detached door handle. She got back in and tried starting the SUV. The engine turned over, followed by a repetitive ding-ding-ding to remind her to fasten her seatbelt. She used the paring knife she'd packed to cut away the airbag. She popped the hood. She checked under there and couldn't find any obvious danger. Checked the tires, and they looked fine. She turned on the lights. That'd be a problem. The right headlight was shattered. The left was cracked, but functional. In the rear, it was the reverse, where the driver's side brake light had been, only a metal cavity remained. The passenger's side brake light, on the other hand, looked fit for a brochure photo. She considered the endless stretches of farmland, the forest behind her, and the one ahead. It could be hours before any help arrived, or it could be minutes. No way to tell. The last time she'd looked at the trip meter, she'd been 70 miles away from Baker Lake, and that had been 10 minutes before the accident, so 65 then. Brian had paid Andrew Gaddis to show up that night at their party and leave her a series of clues. He'd wanted her to know about Baker Lake. It's possible his motive had been to draw her up here and kill her. She'd mulled that over a lot. But if he wanted to kill her, he could have done it on the boat. Instead, he'd faked his own death at her hand. Every time she'd looked at Baker Lake on the maps, it felt like a door. If you crossed the lake, you reached another country. Was Brian leading her to the door? Whether he was or he wasn't, she was out of alternative plans that didn't involve a jail cell and eventual prison. At this point, it was find Brian in Maine or game over. "Here we go," she whispered. She got back in the car and drove away. Above her, the sun was on the run. She left 201 at a place called The Forks, not The Fork singular, The Forks. It was so named, she suspected, because if you wanted to enter the wilderness by trekking northeast from here, the roads, as faint on her map as veins in an X-ray, splintered off 201 and then off one another, and then off one another's progeny until it appeared the only way back would be scent trails or prayer. It was full dark now, the dark of Germanic fairy tales and solar eclipses. She turned onto Granger Mills Passage and drove along it for several miles, or it could have been just a couple. It was slow going up here, before she realized she must have missed the turnoff for Old Mill Lane. She turned back and drove through the black until an anorexic sliver of road appeared on her left. There was no marker to tell her what the road was or where it went. She turned onto it, drove about 400 yards, and it ended. She flashed her sole high beam, and all she saw beyond her grill was an embankment about 4 feet tall and a field on the other side of it. The road had never been a road, just the idea of one soon abandoned. There was no place to turn around, so she put the battered, creaking SUV in reverse and tried to navigate her way back through the pitch with one shattered brake light. Twice she drove into the shoulder. When she reached Granger Mills Passage, she drove back the way she'd come for about 3 miles until she found a cutout alongside some farmland. She pulled in there and killed the engine. She sat in the dark. There'd be no more driving tonight. She sat in the dark and prayed that movement would be just as impossible for him, at least until morning. She sat in the dark and realized she hadn't slept in over 36 hours. She climbed into the back seat, pulled her coat from her backpack, and wrapped it around her, and used the backpack as a pillow. Lying in the dark now, as opposed to sitting in it, closing her eyes. The sun woke her. She looked at her watch. It was 6:30 in the morning. A low mist hung over the fields, beginning to smoke along the upper edges as the sun burned it away.
A cow stood about 10 feet away, on the other side of some loose barbed wire fencing, staring through her with cow eyes, its tail swishing at a small squall of flies. She sat up, and the first thing she wished was that she'd thought to pack a toothbrush. She drank one of the bottles of water, ate a power bar. She stepped out of the car and stretched and saw more cows in the field across the road, more smoking mist. It was cool, even with the sun, and she tightened the coat around her and breathed in the clean air. She peed by the side of the car under the steady, disinterested gaze of the cow, its tail still swishing like the needle of a metronome, and then she got back in the car, U-turned, and headed off. It was only 25 miles to Baker Lake, but it took her 3 hours. Anything one would call a road gave way to what one could only charitably call trails, and she was forever grateful she'd stopped last night because she would have ended up in a ditch or driving into a pond. Soon she was so deep into the wilderness that the trails lost their names, and some that appeared on the map had been reclaimed by the weeds and the brush. She relied on the SUV's compass to continue heading due northeast. The rocky dirt paths crunched under her wheels, and the chassis rocked from side to side like a child's carnival ride, exactly the type of motion that often nauseated her. But she gripped the wheel and stared through the window for the next hard curve or sudden rock formation, and she felt fine. The farmland had given way to tumultuous fields of overgrowth, and those eventually gave way to the return of woodlands. The kind of woodlands Brian had always claimed to be part and parcel of his family history and subsequent career. She realized now that Brian had chosen a symbol to represent himself that was the exact opposite of who he actually was. Wood was dependable, sturdy, you could place your faith in it for generations. Brian, on the other hand, was the biggest liar she'd ever known, and as a reporter, she'd known a lot. Then how did he manage to deceive you? Because I let him. And why would you do that? Because I wanted to feel safe. Safety is an illusion we sell to children to help them sleep. Then I wanted to be a child. The path ended in a small clearing. There were no other paths beyond it, just the small oval of weeds and sand, and then the next forest. She checked her map, but it wasn't detailed enough to include this. She checked her satellite photos and felt hopeful that she'd reached a pale spot on one of them that, if she were correct, would mean she was about 3 miles south of the hunting camp. She changed into her hiking boots and checked that the safety on the P380 was on before she slipped it into her waistband at the small of her back. She'd barely walked 10 feet before the rise and fall of it back there grew uncomfortable, and she moved it to the pocket of her coat. The trees were gargantuan. Their canopies blotted out the sun. She presumed bears lived in these woods, and she had a moment of panic when she couldn't recall how recent her last period had been. But then she remembered. It had been about 10 days ago, so at least her blood wouldn't attract a predator. By the looks of these woods, though, the scent of her flesh might be enough. Nothing human had passed along her footpath in a long time, and whatever hunter may have done so in years past, she was fairly certain he'd been quieter than she. She pushed through like the awkward city girl she was, crunching leaves, snapping twigs, breathing audibly. She heard the lake before she saw it. It wasn't gurgling or lapping against the land. It presented itself as a pocket, a lack of density that removed pressure from her left ear, pressure she hadn't even known was there until it wasn't. Soon, small patches of blue winked through the tree trunks. She turned toward them. In 15 minutes, she stood along the water's edge. There was no shore, just the edge of the forest and a 6-foot drop to the water. She made her way along it for another half an hour before the light changed ahead of her, the trunks of the trees brightening with it, and she picked up her pace and stepped through the last of them into a clearing. The first cabin she encountered was missing all its windows and half its roof. One wall was caved in. The one next to it, however, was the one Gaddis had described. Faded green trim, faded red door, but clearly kept up. No sense of the land reclaiming it, no cracks in the foundation, the steps leading up to it swept clean, the windows dusty but intact. The boards croaked when she climbed the 4 steps to the door. She removed the pistol from her jacket and tried the door.
The knob turned in her hand. She pushed the door open. It smelled of must inside, but not mold or rot, and it smelled of the forest, of pine and moss and bark. The fireplace was swept clean. It didn't smell as if it had been used in a while. In the tiny kitchen, the counters bore a thin film of dust. The fridge was stocked with waters, 3 tall cans of Guinness with the plastic ring still holding them together, and some condiments still shy of their use-by dates. The den, also small, the entire cabin wasn't more than 500 square feet, sported a cracked brown leather couch and a small bookcase filled with adventure novels and positive thinking manuals. This was Brian's place, all right. In the bathroom, she found the toothpaste and shampoo brands he preferred. In the bedroom, she found a queen-size brass bed that squeaked when she sat on it. She walked around a bit more, but found no evidence anyone had been there recently. She went outside and looked for footprints around the cabin, but found none. She sat on the porch as exhaustion found her bones and her brain. She wiped at a tear with the heel of her hand, and then another, but then she sucked hard through her nostrils and stood and shook her head like a dog who'd been caught in the rain. It wasn't just that she would have to trek to the car and drive back toward civilization with not enough daylight to reach it before she'd probably have to pull over with her one working headlight and sleep along the side of the road again. It was that she had nothing to return to. By now, they'd have found Caleb and would have ascertained that she'd been in Providence the same time Nicole Alden had been murdered. The circumstantial evidence might not be enough to convict her in a trial, but she would most definitely go to jail until such a time as that trial was held. Could be a year or more. And who's to say that the circumstantial evidence wouldn't be enough to convict her? Certainly for Caleb's murder. A policeman would go on record saying she'd lied about the victim being alive in her condo when, at that point, he'd been dead. Once they had you on record lying about anything, they could convince a jury you were lying about everything. So she had no home, no life waiting for her. She had $2,000 in cash. She had a change of clothes in a bag and a car she'd have to abandon in the first city where she could find a bus terminal. But a bus to where? And wherever she got, how was she going to survive on $2,000 with her picture on every TV screen and every internet news site in this country? Trudging back through the woods, she rifled through her options until she came to the grim conclusion that she had only 2. Turn herself in, or take the gun from her pocket right now and use it on herself. She found a rock and sat. The lake was an hour back. All she had to look at were trees. She took the gun out of her pocket, hefted it in her palm. Brian, by this point, was probably a continent or two away. Whatever scam he'd been running through Alden Minerals and that mine in Papua New Guinea, he'd run it, and run off with the profits. She'd been played. That was possibly the worst of it, that she'd been used and discarded. To what end, she had no idea, couldn't see what her role had been in all this. She was simply the dupe, the rube, the unforgivably innocent pawn. How long would her body lie among the trees before it was found? Days? Seasons? Or would animals come to feast on it? Years from now, someone would find a bone or two, and the state police would arrive to find the rest. And the mystery of the missing reporter suspected in the murders of 2 people would finally be solved. Parents would tell it as a cautionary tale to wayward teens. "See," they'd say, "she didn't get away with it. Justice prevails. The status quo is reaffirmed. She got what was coming to her." Witty stood about 50 feet away and smiled at her. Her dress was not bloodied. Her throat was intact. She didn't open her mouth when she spoke, but Rachel heard her more clearly than the birds. "You tried. I didn't try hard enough. They would have killed you. Then I should have died. And who would tell my story then? No one will care about your story." "But I lived." Rachel wept into the dirt and the dead leaves. "You lived poor and black on an island no one gives a shit about." "You gave a shit?" She stared through the trees at the girl. "You died because I convinced you to hide. You were right.
If they had found you earlier, they would have raped you, but they wouldn't have cut your throat. They wouldn't have. They would have let you live.
What life?
A life! Rachel screamed.
I wouldn't want that life.
But I want you to be alive, Rachel begged. I need you to be alive.
But I'm gone. Let me go, Miss Rachel. Let me go.
Rachel was staring right at her, and then she was staring at a tree. She wiped her eyes and nose on her sleeve. She cleared her throat. She sucked the forest air into her nostrils. And she heard her mother's voice. Jesus, this had to be dehydration, or exhaustion, or low blood sugar, or maybe she'd already put the gun to her head and fired and she was already dead. But here came Elizabeth Childs and her nicotine vocal cords.
Lie down, her mother said with a distinctly weary benevolence. And soon we'll be together again. And it'll be like that week you were sick in bed, and I never left your side. I'll make all your favorite foods.
Rachel caught herself shaking her head, as if her mother could see her, as if the trees could, as if she were anything but alone. Was this how people went crazy? Ended up talking to themselves on street corners, sleeping in doorways, skin covered in sores? Fuck that. Rachel pocketed the gun and stood. She took in the woods all around her, and she knew she wasn't going to die to make life easier for Brian or Kessler or anyone else who assumed she was too weak for this world. I'm not crazy, she told her mother, told the trees. And I don't want to be with you in the afterlife, mother. She looked at the sky. One lifetime of you was fucking plenty. It was 1 o'clock by the time she reached the SUV. It would take 2 hours to get back to 201. 3 hours on 201 until she hit a town big enough to have a bus station. She'd have to hope buses ran through that small town after 6 in the evening. That's if she were lucky enough to get from here to there without being pulled over for driving an SUV that looked like it had been dropped from a crane. She got behind the wheel and pulled out onto the dirt road. She'd driven for about a mile when the man lying on the back seat said,
"Fuck happened to Caleb's car? You look good, by the way."
He sat up, smiled at her in the rear view. Brian. Chapter 30. Primal Self. She stood on the brakes, slammed the gear shift into park, and unlatched her seatbelt. Brian sat up halfway in the back seat as she came through the space between the two front seats and punched him in the side of the face. She had no experience with hitting someone, particularly with a closed fist. It stung her knuckles far worse than she would have expected, but she knew a direct hit when she heard one, and her fist connecting with Brian's face made a sound as sharp and solid as any she'd ever heard. She watched his eyes water and grow disoriented. So she hit him again. She pinned his shoulders with her knees. She punched his ear and his eye and the side of his face again. He bucked at her with his upper body, but the weight imbalance was all on her side, and she knew the only rule at this point was to not stop until something forced her to. She heard his voice asking her to stop, her own voice calling him motherfucker over and over, saw his eyes scrunched up against the flurry of her fists. He squirmed his right shoulder free, and that turned her awkwardly to her left, and he pushed off the footwell and the seat. She fell back through the space between the two front seats, and he loomed up in the back seat, surging toward her. She kicked him in the face. If anything, it connected more thoroughly than her first punch. Bone or cartilage cracked, and the back of his head slammed into the window. He opened and closed his mouth several times, as if he were nibbling on the air, and then his eyes rolled back to the whites, and he lost consciousness.
I knocked someone out.
A small laugh popped from her mouth as she watched Brian's eyes flutter under his sagging eyelids. Her right hand was already swelling and was slick with blood. His blood. His face, she realized with both shock and surprising concern, was battered, and she was pretty sure it hadn't been battered 5 minutes ago.
I did that?
She took the car key and the gun with her and got out of the car and stood on the road. She experienced the worst craving she'd had for a cigarette since she'd quit 7 years ago. She inhaled the impossibly fresh forest air instead, and she couldn't relate even a little bit to the person she'd been just hours ago, the one who'd contemplated suicide, the one who'd thought of giving up. Fuck giving up. I'll give up when I die, and it won't be by my hand. His door creaked open, and his palms appeared above the window. The rest of him stayed below the roofline.
You done?
With what?
Beating the shit out of me.
Her right hand was screaming now, but she wrapped it around the pistol just the same.
Yeah, I guess.
He raised his head above the roofline, and she pointed the pistol at him.
Jesus!
He ducked down again. She came around the car in three long strides and trained the gun on him.
Blanks?
He lowered his hands from around his head and straightened from a crouch, resigned to his fate suddenly.
What? Did you put blanks in this gun, too?
He shook his head. She pointed the gun at his chest.
No, really!
He raised his hands again, so maybe not so resigned after all.
Those are real fucking bullets in there.
Yeah? His eyes widened because he could see hers suddenly, could see what was in them. She pulled the trigger. Brian hit the ground. Well, he bounced off the vehicle first, trying to brake to his left to escape the bullet, bounced off the SUV, landed on the ground, hands still up in the universal, if wholly ineffectual, please don't shoot me gesture.
Get up, she said.
He stood, looked at the chunk of bark she'd shot out of the thin pine to his right. Blood dripped from his nose, over his lips, and off his chin. He wiped at it with his forearm. He spit red into the green grass by the side of the road.
That looks like real blood. How'd you fake the blood in your mouth on the boat?
Wanna guess?
A small smile found his eyes, but not his lips. She put herself back on the boat, back in their conversation. She could see him sitting there so calmly as she confronted him about his second wife and second life. And he just sat there, eating.
The peanuts, she said.
He gave her a half-hearted thumbs up.
Two of them were squibs, yeah.
He shot the gun a wary eye.
What are you going to do here, Rachel?
I haven't decided yet, Brian.
She lowered the gun for a moment. He lowered his hands.
If you kill me, and I wouldn't blame you, you're fucked. No money, no way of getting any, wanted for questioning in a murder, and hunted
two murders.
Two?
She nodded. He processed that, and then continued.
You're also being hunted by some very bad fucking guys. If you kill me, you're staring down two, maybe three more days of free air and picking your own clothes to wear, and I know how you like to be stylish, honey.
She raised the gun again. He raised his hands. He cocked an eyebrow at her. She cocked one back at him. And in that moment, what in the hell, she felt connected to him. Felt like she wanted to laugh. All the rage remained, all the sense of betrayal and fury at him for dismantling her trust, her life, and yet entwined with it, for just a moment, were all the old feelings. It took every bit of muscle control she could muster not to smile.
Speaking of stylish, she said, you're not looking it right now.
He touched his face with his fingers, came back with blood. He looked at his reflection in the window of the SUV.
I think you broke my nose.
Sounded like it at the time.
He lifted the hem of his t-shirt up his chest and dabbed at his face.
I've got a first aid kit stashed nearby. Could we go back for it?
Why should I do you any favors, dear?
Because I've also got an SUV back there that doesn't look like someone drove it off a fucking bridge, dear.
They drove back to the clearing, and then walked into the woods no more than 20 feet, and there sat, perfectly camouflaged, a forest green Range Rover, early 90s vintage, some rust in the wheel wells, some dents in the rear quarter panels, but the tires were new, and it had the look of something that would run another 20 years. She kept the gun on Brian as he retrieved a first aid kit from a canvas cargo bin in the back. He sat on the bed under the raised hatchback and rummaged around in the bin until he came up with a shaving mirror. He went to work swabbing the cuts clean with rubbing alcohol, wincing occasionally, scrunching his face against the stings.
Where should I start?
He said. Where can you?
Oh, it's easy. You came in during the late innings. I put this in motion a long time ago.
And what is this?
In the parlance of my business, it's a salting scam.
And your business is? He looked up at her with mild hurt and dismay, like a fading movie star she'd failed to recognize.
I'm a grifter.
A con man.
I prefer grifter. It's got some panache to it. Con man just sounds like, I don't know, some guy could be selling you penny stocks or fucking Amway.
So you're a grifter? He nodded and handed her some alcohol swabs for her knuckles. She nodded her thanks, tucked the gun in her waistband, and took a few steps back from him as she cleaned her knuckles.
About 5 years ago, I came across a bankrupt mine for sale in Papua New Guinea, so I formed a corporation and I bought the mine.
What do you know about mines?
Nothing.
He worked on the blood in his nose with a Q-tip.
Jesus,
he said softly, with something akin to admiration.
You fucked me up, girl.
The mine. She suppressed another smile.
So we bought the mine, and simultaneously Caleb created a consulting company with an entirely fictitious but quite believable deep history in Latin America, generations of it, if you didn't look too closely. 3 years later, that company, Borgo Engineering, undertook an independent study of the mine, which by that point we'd salted.
What's salting?
You sprinkle a mine with gold in places that are easier to access, but not too easy, than others. The idea is one of extrapolation. If X percentage of gold is found here, then one can assume the totality of the mine is sitting on Y percentage. That's what our independent consultants, Borgo Engineering.
He tipped an imaginary cap to her.
That's what they ascertained, that we were sitting on resources worth up to 400 million troy ounces of gold, as opposed to 4 million.
Which would drive your stock up?
If we had stock, but we didn't. No, what it would do was make us a potential threat to any competitors in the region.
Vitterman.
You have been doing your research.
I did spend 10 years as a reporter.
You did? So what else did you find out?
That you probably got a loan from a VC concern called Cotter McCann? He nodded.
And why would they loan us money?
Ostensibly to help shore the company up against a hostile takeover by Vitterman, while you pulled enough gold out of there to make the company impregnable to take over. He nodded again. But, she said, word around the campfire is that Cotter McCann is predatory.
Very, he confirmed.
So they were going to eat up your little mine and all its profits anyway?
Yep.
But there wouldn't be any profits. He was watching her carefully now, dabbing at the last of his cuts. How much was the loan for? She asked. He smiled.
70 million.
In cash? She had to force herself to keep her voice low. He nodded.
And another 450 million in stock options.
But the options are worthless.
See.
She walked in a small circle, her feet crunching leaves and pine needles, until she got it. All you've been after from the beginning was the 70 million.
Yep.
And you got that 70 million? He tossed the last of the bloody swabs into a plastic bag, held the bag out in front of her.
Oh, did I ever. It's sitting in a bank in Grand Cayman, waiting for me to walk in and pick it up.
She dropped her own bloody swabs in the bag. So what's the hitch in this great plan of yours? His face darkened.
The hitch is that the moment we wired the money out of the account in Rhode Island, we were on a clock. That kind of transaction gets noticed quick, particularly by the likes of Cotter McCann. We made two mistakes. We underestimated just how fast they'd notice the wire, because we had no way of knowing they had someone on the payroll in Homeland who flagged it for an SAR.
Which is?
Suspicious activity report. We knew we'd get flagged, but there's normally a delay between the flagging and the payer hearing about it.
What else didn't you count on?
You got an hour?
He said ruefully.
You try something like this. There's about 500 things that can go wrong, and only one that can go right. So we didn't count on them putting a tracker on my car. And they didn't even do it because they were suspicious at that point. They did it because it's their standard operating procedure.
And they followed you where?
Same place as you did. Nicole's.
Something caught in his voice. Authentic grief, she would have assumed, if she didn't know how good an actor he was.
They probably missed me by 10 minutes. But they found her. And they killed her.
He exhaled a steady stream of air through pursed lips. He stepped out from under the hatchback abruptly, closed it, and clapped his hands together.
Anything else you really, really need to know right now that can't wait?
About 100 things.
That can't wait, he repeated.
How'd you look so dead, at the bottom of the harbor, with the blood flowing out of you and the... She waved her hands as she trailed off.
Stagecraft, he said. The blood was easy, that's all squibs. The ones in my chest were wired up before you got on the boat. The ones in my mouth came out of the bag of peanuts, as you know. The oxygen tank was waiting for me as long as I could get to that rock in time. You dove in fast, by the way. Shit, I barely had time to get situated.
The look, she said impatiently. You looked right at me with dead eyes and a dead face.
Like this?
It was as if someone had plunged a needle full of strychnine into the base of his brain. All light bled from his eyes and then from the rest of his face. It wasn't only that his face grew impossibly still, its spirit vacated. She waved her hand in front of his eyes and they remained fixed on nothing and never blinked. How long can you do this? She asked. He let out a breath.
I probably could have done it another 20 seconds.
And if I'd stayed down there, looking at you?
Oh, I had maybe 40 more seconds, a minute tops. But you didn't. And that's what a good grift always relies on, that people will act predictably.
If they're not Cotter McCann.
Touché.
He clapped his hands together again, and the ghoulish aura of death left his face.
Well, we're still on a tight clock, so mind if I download the rest to you while we go?
Go where? He pointed north.
Canada. Caleb's meeting us there in the morning.
Caleb, she said.
Yeah. Where'd you ditch him, the safe house?
She stared back at him, no idea what to say.
Rachel.
He stopped with his hand on the driver's side door.
Please tell me you went to the safe house after the boat.
We never made it. His face drained.
Where's Caleb?
He's dead, Brian. He put both hands to his face. He brought them back down and then pressed them flat against the windows of the Range Rover. He lowered his head and didn't seem to breathe for a full minute.
How'd he die?
They shot him in the face. He came off the car, looked at her. She nodded.
Who?
I don't know. 2 men looking for a key. He looked helpless. Worse, she realized, bereft. He gave the woods a wild look, as if he were about to faint again, and then he slid down the side of the Range Rover and sat on the ground. He trembled, wept. In 3 years, she'd never seen this Brian. She'd never seen anything close. Brian didn't cave. Brian didn't break. Brian didn't need help. She was witnessing the reduction of him, the essential pieces at the core of him being removed and carted off. She engaged the safety on the pistol and placed it behind her back and sat on the ground across from him. He wiped at his eyes and sucked air in through wet nostrils that still glistened with blood. His hands shook along with his lips when he said,
"You saw him die?"
She nodded. "He was as close to me as you are now. The guy just shot him."
"Who were these guys?"
He blew air through his lips in short bursts. "I don't know. They looked like they sell insurance, and not the high-end kind, the kind you get at strip malls."
"How'd you get away from them?"
She told him, and in the telling, she watched him return a bit to form. The trembling stopped, his eyes cleared.
"He had the key," he said.
"It's over. Game fucking over."
"What key?"
"Safe deposit box at a bank."
She fingered the key in her pocket. "Bank in the Caymans?" He shook his head.
"Rhode Island. That last day, I carried around a bad feeling, an ugly hunch, I guess. Either that or I was simply panicked like a fucking child. I dropped our passports in the bank. If anyone got to me, I figured Nicole could get to them. But they got to Nicole instead, so I handed the key off to Caleb.
What passports?
He nodded. Mine, Caleb's, Haya's, the baby's, Nicole's, yours.
I don't have a passport anymore. He stood wearily and held out his hand.
Yes, you do.